This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Fundamental science, knowledge for knowledge's sake, not really knowing what part of the technical industry will it serve. That's suffering right now.
Close your eyes and imagine a physicist. What does this person look like? Was it a white guy? Well, if it was, you might be guilty of reaffirming stereotypes, but you wouldn't be wrong statistically speaking. According to the American Institute of Physics, less than 1% of American physicists are women of color. This week on Sea Change Radio, we sit down with one such rarity, groundbreaking physicist Hattie Carwell. She helps us understand what the specialty of health physics encompasses, talks about the museum she co-founded showcasing African Americans in science, and recounts her extraordinary story of achieving renown in the scientific community in the face of racism and sexism. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Hattie Carwell. She is a health physicist and the co-founder of the Museum of African American Technology. Hattie, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what is a health physicist?
A health physicist is a physicist that primarily focuses on radiation safety and protection. Protection involves assuring that facilities that generate radiation are safe. There's no leakage to the environment. People working around equipment are not overexposed to radiation. There are programs in place following regulations set up by the state and federal government to ensure that the environment and people are safe.
And what is the Museum of African American Technology? And maybe kind of tell us the mission of the organization.
Well, the Museum of African American Technology Science Village is actually a archiver of the achievements of African Americans in science and engineering. Also, it presents seminars, exhibitions, and special programs particularly targeted for students anywhere from age 6 till 84.
And when was it founded? And maybe kind of give us an idea of the growth and vision for where it's going.
The museum was actually founded in 2000, the year 2000, as an outgrowth of an exhibition that the Northern California Council of Black Professional Engineers sponsors. The exhibition was on George Washington Carver, and it was held at Jack London Square. As a result of the visitors to that exhibition, one of the founders of the Northern California Council of Black Professional Engineers indicated that he really enjoyed the exhibition and stated, wouldn't it be great if we could have this type of exhibition on an ongoing basis? I reminded him that for some years, the engineers had planned a museum, but had never gotten around to doing it. So he indicated that he would give some startup money. And as a result, the museum came into existence in July 2000.
And is there a network of these museums or educational facilities? I'm just thinking we're here in Oakland, California, but if somebody's listening in St. Louis or Atlanta, what kind of facilities, what kind of opportunities might they have to go visit something similar?
This museum is so unique, it's the only one in existence to my knowledge.
Wow. So why don't you take us back to your journey? I'd like to hear, as an African-American woman who became a renowned physicist, why don't you kind of walk us through what challenges you faced and privileges you were afforded as a young woman?
Well, I'll start with the generation of my interest. I went to a segregated school. I went to the same school for 12 years.
Where was that?
In Ashland, Virginia, a very small town, population 3,000. And one of the things that always occurred at our school was science competitions. Individual students were selected to, I guess, accelerate their study in the sciences and compete in these competitions. And I liked them because I got to travel. And so I participated in those types of competitions from sixth grade through high school. And it was in the middle 60s, and much to my chagrin, I thought by the time I grew up, it would all be history and there would be nothing left to do. Big surprise. There was plenty left to do when I came out of high school and college.
So maybe you can talk about your family and its philosophy towards education, and how much of your educational journey was self-motivated and how much you were influenced by your family?
Well, I would say I've been influenced throughout life by my community, family, educators, and friends. First of all, I must say, I was raised by my aunt and uncle in Virginia. I was actually born in Brooklyn, New York. I was the middle child of seven. And my aunt and uncle had no children, and they offered to take me and raise me in Virginia. I maintained contact with my immediate family throughout that time. I would spend summers in New York with my brothers and sisters. And my aunt and uncle had a secondary education. My uncle in particular was very high on education because he had missed out. So he always talked about the importance of an education, what you could do with an education. So anything that I needed in support of education was guaranteed. Not that they had money, but in terms of pointing me in the right direction and seeking out opportunities for me, they were definitely doing that.
And so where did you go to college?
I went to Bennett College, one of the only two colleges that are for Black American women only. It's a women's college in Greensboro, North Carolina. So when I was considering going to college, I certainly was encouraged by my teachers. I was valedictorian, and they wanted to make sure that I had an opportunity to further develop my potential. And most of the teachers that I was closest to were the science teachers. And I was the type of person back then, if an adult said something was good for you, I believed it. So when I went to college, I majored in biology and chemistry. I loved my chemistry teacher. I started off in biology and added chemistry just because it was so interesting when he taught it. And then when I finished college, I wanted to go on to graduate school. And I saw an advertisement for your graduate record exam being paid for if you applied for a special fellowship in radiation science. And that was my introduction to health physics. I really didn't know what it was or what it was about, but at least I was going to get my graduate record exam paid for. Part of that program, once your scores came out, they were automatically circulated to various schools that offered the radiation science program. I ended up going to Rutgers University, got a scholarship or a fellowship to attend there. And so I got my degree in health physics from that institution. But my first job was at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I stayed there about 9 months. I got an offer at Brookhaven National Lab. So after 9 months, I moved from Thomas Jefferson to Brookhaven National Lab on Long Island in Upton, New York.
And so what did you do at Brookhaven?
I worked for the Atomic Energy Commission, providing oversight on the radiation program at Brookhaven, making sure that their design facilities were in compliance and also that they were in compliance with the federal and state regulations applying to them. After Brookhaven, I started at what was the San Francisco Operations Office, still as the Atomic Energy Commission. It later became the Oakland Operations Office for the U.S. Department of Energy.
So you moved out to the Bay Area in 73 or 4?
73, the fall of 73. I left the Bay Area, however, in 1980. I wanted to take a period of time to work for the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Commission. And there I worked as a nuclear safeguards inspector and later became a group leader with that organization. I was assigned facilities in Europe, so I went to various facilities throughout Europe that had signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which basically was a promise they would use radiation for peaceful purposes and not for clandestine purposes.
And then you returned to the Bay Area?
I returned to the Bay Area after 5 years of being in Vienna, Austria with the IAEA.
Oh, what a lovely, precious dream. To be young, gifted, and black. Open your heart to what I mean, to what I mean.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to health physicist and the co-founder of the Museum of African American Technology, Hattie Carwell. So what kind of differences did you sense in terms of reactions to you, if you can kind of contrast Austria in the 80s versus Oakland in the 70s?
I would say being in Austria for those 5 years was probably the best time for me of my career. And I say that because, one, I was there representing the United States. They had great respect for the United States. I was protected because I carried an American passport and a laissez-passer, or let go, for the IAEA, meaning I was probably the safest in my lifetime and the most respected in my lifetime under those circumstances.
In terms of, you had real high security clearance, et cetera?
Yes, I had a security clearance. But believe it or not, it could cause a global incident if I was offended in some way or something were to happen to me.
Treated you?
I was very well treated. It was assumed by virtue of the fact that I was there that I was qualified. And so second guessing, can she do the job? Will she do the job? Traveling internationally is the best circumstances of my career.
Was it a little disheartening to come back to the United States and maybe not have that same status?
It was. It definitely was, because the conversation about the status of African Americans in the U.S. hadn't budged very much in 5 years. Many of the old problems and challenges still existed. And particular, since I had been gone for 5 years, I experienced the fact, some had forgotten that I existed, because it's a privilege to work for the IAEA. You're seconded by your government to go there and work. And your agency is supposed to keep you informed of promotion opportunities while you're gone. And I didn't quite get that treatment while I was gone. There were several things that had happened in my division while I was gone that I know I would have applied for, but I wasn't told.
So Hattie, the only period we haven't really covered is 1985 to 2000. What did you do during that period?
Well, I came back and continued to work at the San Francisco Operations Office of the U.S. Department of Energy. However, to put in perspective, what I did when I returned was not to stop what I was doing while I was in Vienna and before going to Vienna. In 1977, I wrote a book on Blacks in science. I had attended a conference and I heard my first paper about the achievements of Black in science, and I found it fascinating. And so I went to the libraries trying to find additional information, which was difficult to find. And so I ended up writing a book because I thought others would be just as fascinated as I had been.
So let's fast forward to today. After a career involved in either directly or tangentially to the nuclear industry, to see reactors around the country being put out of commission, how do you feel about the future of nuclear energy globally at this point?
Well, I've always been a supporter of nuclear energy as being part of the mix of energy options. In Europe, while I was there, France basically passed an initiative that more than 25% of their energy would be generated from nuclear. And I find the contrast interesting. The U.S. is supposed to be progressive, but they were lagging behind in terms of making such bold decisions. In fact, nuclear has had a mixed reception, even to today. And I would say if anything, be it significant or not, negative happened in nuclear, it would just put the last nail in the coffin.
Yes, I mean, Chernobyl and Fukushima happen decades apart, and yet they loom as a specter over the industry as a whole, don't
Most
they?
Most definitely.
and Three Mile Island.
Yes. I would just say the biggest problem, remaining problem in nuclear industry is management of the waste. The U.S. to this date really does not have a solid plan to manage and control the waste that's generated.
Just sending it all to Nevada is not a great plan, huh?
Well, the better plan would be how to reduce the waste, how to avoid the waste. When you're trying to preserve and basically babysit the waste for thousands of years, that's a little difficult given political climates and the wide range of things that can happen, even at a remote waste handling site.
Speaking of political climates and industries under attack, you saw the nuclear industry atrophy through the last few decades, but science as a whole is now under attack in this country. How can people who spend a lot of time and money learning their craft get dismissed by a political agenda, especially when so much is at risk when it comes to something like climate change?
Well, I don't think we're there yet, because there is still a large demand for technical talent in science and engineering. And in regard to the African-American community, there's a large demand to produce as many as we can, just because of the shift in demographics. Who will do the science, say, in 2030? Who will be around? Demographically, the population will have shifted to minorities. So the demand is there and it's not being met. So I don't think the African American community per se is in danger from that perspective. Now, in terms of getting the science needed done and having enough people because of underfunding, that's the bigger question. And we already have evidence of certain projects that are very expensive are not being undertaken in this country. And in a field that's related to the nuclear industry is high energy physics. It's over a decade ago now, the U.S. decided that it would not build another large accelerator to do fundamental scientific study. And I think what you've been alluding to is more fundamental science, knowledge for knowledge's sake, not really knowing what part of the technical industry will it serve. That's suffering right now. The prime example I could give you is up at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. It developed the first accelerator. And as a result of the experiments done up there, plutonium and all of the heavy elements were discovered using particle accelerators. I'll give the perspective. At one time, there were 8 accelerators at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. There's 3 now.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to health physicist Hattie Carwell. So, Hattie, what other projects are you involved in beyond the Museum of African American Technology and the Science Village here in Oakland? You mentioned that you do speaking around the country.
So in addition to the museum, which encourages youth to pursue careers in science and technology, I started a national scholarship fund while I was still in Vienna. And that group, the Development Fund for Black Students in Science and Technology, provides scholarships that are renewable to students who pursue technical degrees in science and technology at historically Black colleges. In addition to that, about 6 years ago, a coalition, which I am the president, was formed. It's the Coalition of Hispanic, African, and Native Americans for the Next Generation of Engineers and Scientists. Now, this I consider important because there are many barriers that prevent minorities getting into science, not just getting interested, getting degrees and jobs at the level of senior managers. Policies need to be changed, and someone needs to study the conditions that exist and bring pressure to bear to bring change.
And what are you excited about in the next couple of years in terms of your own scientific journey?
I want to go to Antarctica in 2021 when there's a total solar eclipse.
Are you going to do that?
I am most definitely going to do that. I have a cabin reserved and have made my deposit. So I'm very excited. I became interested in the 70s. I met an African-American woman who did research for the Naval Research Laboratory. And she had gone to Antarctica. And I was talking to her 20 years later after she had taken the trip, and she spoke about it like it was 20 minutes ago.
Hattie Carwell, thank you so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Ripple, Donnie Hathaway, and The Notations.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.